A cartoon takes up half of the front page of the Irish News. It's by Ian Knox, and it shows two men being whirled out a revolving door, presumably Edwin Poots and Paul Given, while Arlene Foster looks on, grinning. "Poots stands down as DUP implodes," says the headline. The story gets a more sober treatment in the Belfast Telegraph, but the message is the same. "Poots out after 21 days as leader," is the headline, over a dark photograph by Brian Lawless of the short-lived head of the Democratic Unionist Party in Stormont yesterday. Suzanne Breen writes that the man he defeated to take the leadership from Arlene Foster, Geoffrey Donaldson, is now favoured to succeed him. "Don't go abroad if you're under 30. That's the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mail, summing up the advice of the chief medical officer that those who are not fully vaccinated should not go abroad, regardless of whether they have a negative PCR test. Dr. Tony Houlihan's advice gives the Irish Independent its lead story too. "Young told to keep lives on hold as vaccine rollout slows," says the headline. Though the report below that quotes Dr. Houlihan as saying, "There's plenty of good holiday opportunities in this country." The Irish Times' latest opinion poll provides further thought on the subject. 50% of respondents said they want the government to proceed with the full reopening of society as quickly as possible. But almost the same number, 46%, said they want the reopening to take place at a much slower pace. A large majority, 65%, said that even after most people are vaccinated, some precautions should remain in place, such as wearing masks in shops. There is much coverage of the tributes paid to a 15-year-old County Carlow girl, Tiggy Hancock, who died following an accident at an equestrian centre in Dublin. The Irish Daily Star says she was a rising star in the sport of eventing. The Irish Daily Mirror quotes a family friend, Edmund Carney, who said that Tiggy represented Ireland several times and she had a very bright future. A criticism of the Tánaiste by the deputy leader of Sinn Féin provides the Irish Examiner's lead story. Pearse Doherty accused Leo Varadkar of failing to understand public anger at the housing crisis by playing down concerns about property prices, the paper says. And Mr. Varadkar features in a Times front page story too, where he is quoted as saying that there are problems with the new National Maternity Hospital project planned for the St. Vincent's campus. The paper reports that at a private briefing with the Minister for Health yesterday, government and opposition TDs were told that the state has tried everything possible to buy the land which the hospital will be built on, but has failed to do so.
Well, they say a week is a long time in politics, and it's certainly been a roller coaster few days in Northern Ireland politics. Having quit on Monday, former First Minister Arlene Foster was enjoying her lunch in Belfast yesterday, while the man who ousted her as leader of the DUP, Edwin Poots, faced a party revolt, and he ended up last night announcing he'll quit as leader. Besides all that, today's North-South Ministerial Council meeting has been postponed at the request of the Northern side. Our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney, joins us from Belfast this morning. Vincent, just how bad is the disarray in the DUP this morning?
Quite astounding on you. I mean, I said yesterday I've been covering politics up here for about 30 years and I've never witnessed anything quite like this. A couple of occasions yesterday, we had to pinch ourselves, the journalists who were covering this, because we just couldn't believe what was unfolding. And to give you some kind of, you know, a demonstration of just how bad the situation is for Edwin Poots, when he became leader of the party, he won the vote by 19 votes to 17. So we all knew that the party was deeply divided and split. Yesterday morning, before going into the assembly to nominate his close friend Paul Given to be First Minister, assembly members met privately, along with MPs and some of the peers, members of the House of Lords, to decide whether or not he should go ahead and nominate Paul Given, because there was such outrage at the British government announcement that it would bring in Irish language legislation. That was seen as a surrender to Sinn Féin, who demanded such a move. We understand that in that meeting, he lost the vote by 26 votes to 8. Now, that gives you some kind of a sense of the swing against Edwin Poots. And then he went into a meeting of party officers last night. There are 11 party officers in the DUP, including Edwin Poots. Now, unfortunately for him, that room was packed with people who were set against him. The other party officers included Geoffrey Donaldson, the man who had he had beaten in the leadership contest by just 2 votes. Sammy Wilson and Gregory Campbell, 2 MPs who were opposed to him. It also included Diane Dodds, who he had sacked as economy minister. Peter Weir, who he had sacked as education minister. So he picked a fight in the wrong room. And we were told that yesterday there was a sense that he was going to lose that possibly by 10 votes to 1. That's how that's the level of anger and opposition there was to him. And my understanding was yesterday he was simply given an ultimatum. He said, look, you can resign yourself, or the party officers were going to declare that they had no confidence in him. They were going to potentially go to a vote of no confidence, and they counted the numbers during the day and were told that the large number of DUP MLAs in the Assembly and the MPs would have voted against him, possibly something like that margin of 26-8. So what a swing in just a matter of a few weeks. He'd gone from a narrow lead to the vast majority of the elected members of the DUP saying they no longer have any confidence in his leadership. Quite astonishing.
And what about the position of the new First Minister and the fact that the North-South Ministerial Council meeting is not happening today at the request of the Northern side?
The position of Paul Given will cause a fair bit of concern in Dublin and London, because this potentially leads to more instability. My understanding is that Paul Given, even if he had wanted to go to that North-South Ministerial meeting today, my understanding is that the party officers instructed him he was not going to go, because many of them wanted to cut North-South relations as part of their campaign against the Northern Ireland Protocol, and they believe that going to that meeting today would have been political electoral suicide for them going forward. So Paul Given was not going to go. Now, the problem for the party is that they actually can't force Paul Given to stand down. He can only be removed in one of two ways. Firstly, Michelle O'Neill steps down as Deputy First Minister, and that would automatically force him out of office as well. Or secondly, Paul Given himself resigns. Now, that would once again trigger a 7-day process for the executive to get things back together again, for Sinn Féin and the DUP to agree to go back into government again. And there is a concern, certainly, among other parties in the Assembly, and a concern in Dublin and London, that Paul Given may well be put in a position where he resigns, and that triggers that 7-day countdown clock again. Now, if that happens, the new DUP leader, who is widely expected to be Geoffrey Donaldson, is likely to press the British government for some kind of concessions, in the way Sinn Féin pressed for concessions on Irish language legislation. And if those concessions aren't made, the DUP at this stage may not nominate a First Minister, and that would lead to an election. So there's a lot at stake here. All eyes are on Paul Given, because the problem for him is, at the moment, he's a lame duck First Minister. The majority of his own party members yesterday voted saying it was the wrong time to nominate him. The person who nominated him, his good friend, his political ally, Edwin Poots, is stepping down as party leader. He finds himself isolated, and the problem for him is, if he continues, he could become the face of opposition for Loyalists. They could target him with all their criticism and all their blame for what's going wrong with Stormont. So yesterday he described as the proudest moment of his life. He had a huge smile on his face, he had a spring in his step, delighted to have been made First Minister. And he's woken up this morning to a nightmare.
Northern editor Vincent Kearney, thank you for that.
Lots of ramifications north of the border, and what now for North-South relations? The most immediate fallout is the postponement, as Anya and Vincent were saying, of the North-South Ministerial Council. John Downing is political correspondent with the Irish Independent. And John, you're writing today, 23 years on from the new dawn of the Good Friday Agreement. Things are a mess. What is the reaction from an Taoiseach and from the rest of the government here?
Well, in the immediate, if we're looking at the DUP is completely riven at a time when we're facing yet again into another marching season. We have the ominous issue of the protocol, the special trade status of Northern Ireland post-Brexit. the hope in Dublin was that things could settle down, that there would be strong leadership in the DUP, that a compromise, a face-saving compromise could emerge and life would go on. There was a lot of encouragement, I think specifically a fortnight ago, when Edmund Poots showed up in Dublin at very short notice and spoke very strongly about the need to do, quote-unquote, do business. The longer term, we may be looking at very big change in political configuration in Northern Ireland, but for the next 11 months, at a time when unity and cohesiveness is required, the broader unionist community in the north is very, very split and quite fractured.
No North-South Ministerial Council taking place today. So how will Micheál Martin, Leo Varadkar, Simon Coveney play this? Because unionists, and notably Jim Allister giving voice yesterday to perhaps much unionist feeling, pointing the finger in his interview on the 6-1 at Simon Coveney and at Leo Varadkar.
Well, yet again, they've emerged as the bête noire of the this whole farrago. But it is up to Dublin really to keep the head and keep working, hope that the DUP can resolve their difficulties sooner rather than later, and hope they have somebody who can come up with solutions. They will be possibly looking at Geoffrey Donaldson as the most likely candidate there, but they will also be seeking. They were very hopeful yesterday. The very optimistic signs right across the three parties of government that this device that had been contrived to switch the Irish language legislation to Westminster, that might work. It was a device which backfired hopelessly.
I wonder too, John, given what has happened in the last 24 hours, if Leo Varadkar will regret perhaps not his comments on a united Ireland, but the timing of those comments.
Well, if he doesn't, he should, because the timing was absolutely deplorable.
He was not to know, John.
He was not. No, of course, he could know. Nobody would have foreseen Edwin Poots being oxtered out of his job so unceremoniously and so quickly. But he certainly knew the difficulties around the Irish language legislation and the ongoing conflicts about the protocol, and everybody knows we're in the marching season in the north.
Finally, just on a different matter, which we will come back to again later in the programme, the National Maternity Hospital row is back on, with again the Taoiseach yesterday acknowledging the problems. What's going to happen here?
Well, there's certainly very serious doubt. Up to now, this public signs from government were that this one was fixed and it would go ahead. The strange exchanges in the Dáil chamber yesterday between the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and Breed Smith of People Before Profit, she was questioning two things: the land ownership for the planned new maternity hospital adjoining St Vincent's Hospital, not owned by the state, owned by a charity, a sort of successor to the Sisters of Charity. The second thing is the structure of the board. Breed Smith obviously raising questions about the religious ethos of the new institution. Would it impact on services which are legal in this state by now? The Taoiseach is saying there can be no doubt all services which are legal, such as IVF, such as termination, such as sterilisation, they will have to be provided by the new maternity hospital. But he acknowledged very openly that there are concerns about the ownership. It will be owned by a charity and leased to the state. And secondly, the structure of the board governing the hospital. Mm-hmm. The Taoiseach is saying it's going to be 100% funded by the state. The government should have the say in the majority of board appointments. And a very telling comment to Breed Smith, where he basically said, "You and I have far more in common on this issue than you would think."
John Downing of the Irish Independent, thanks for your time this morning.
Pride festivals have been going on all over Ireland recently, celebrating the LGBTQ community here. But next, we're going to talk to Menina Griffith about the latest developments in Waterford, where Pride flags have been removed and burned this past month. And this has been followed by so-called straight Pride posters being put up all over the city. Menina Griffith, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Fill us in on what's been happening in Waterford. This isn't getting any better, is it?
No, as you said, there's been great work going on around the country, and we know from Chill Out, the young people, the youth service in Waterford, that they were involved in the Pride of Dacia festival. Flags were raised by the mayor in council buildings and in the mall on the 4th of June as part of that festival, which took place on the 4th to the 6th. And then in the early hours of Monday the 7th, flags were taken down and burnt. Wednesday the 9th, then the flags were raised again on the mall. And on Saturday the 12th, they discovered that the flags had been taken down again. And then on Friday the 11th in the inner city was completely plastered then with these so-called straight pride posters by a group of small, I think what we can call extremists. They're not representative of the majority of people in Waterford City and the surrounds. So deeply disappointing and very sad for the young LGBT people who put mm-hmm. so much work into this with officials and representatives in Waterford to make sure to celebrate LGBT pride and to make sure that LGBT young people were visible, valued and respected in the city.
Not just in Waterford, there's also been incidents with homophobic graffiti in Dublin, haven't there?
Yeah, during the week, the Panty Bar, which is a well-known gay bar, was defaced as well with graffiti, homophobic graffiti as well. That's been removed now. And I really think that, you know, it's a stark reminder that, as far as we have come over the last decade in Ireland in terms of equality for LGBT citizens with marriage equality, and gender recognition for trans mm-hmm. adults, there is still a lot of work to do to dismantle homophobia and transphobia that's deeply held still by some people in Ireland.
The levels of abuse, I mean, despite, you know, the celebrations, and there have been some fantastic celebrations of Pride and, you know, the flags everywhere and a community that had to hide their humanity and their love for so long being able to celebrate that. But despite all of that, despite the referendum result, talk to us about the levels of abuse being experienced by LGBTQ people across Ireland and whether the forthcoming hate crime and online abuse legislation, do you think is that going to be enough to change that?
Well, we think it's a really important part of it. It won't be enough by itself, but it's really important to outlaw and address extremist language and behaviour, because we know from, you know, our neighbours in the US and the UK that if you don't address this kind of form of homophobia or transphobia online, it can tend to, I suppose, bleed, and that toxicity can have an impact in real life as well. We also know, look, that marriage equality and gender recognition wasn't going to eradicate homophobia or bias and prejudice overnight. There's still a lot of work to do in our schools, in our communities, and even in our homes. We recently did a survey of LGBT young people to find out how they're getting on during lockdown. And it was really heartbreaking, the number of young people, over 50% of them, that said that they were in houses, in homes during the lockdown that weren't fully accepting of their gender identity or sexual orientation. That range from just it being ignored and not being discussed right up to abuse and homophobia. So, you know, these examples in Waterford City and Dublin City are very much extreme, and I imagine that they won't be condoned. And in fact, the majority of people are absolutely appalled by it. But we have to tackle the kind of unconscious bias and homophobic language and behavior in our schools, in our sports, in our communities, and really need to support parents, guardians, and carers to make sure that young people feel valued and respected, irrespective of their gender identity or sexual orientation.
All right, thank you for talking to us this morning. Mininha Griffith there, the Executive Director of Belong to Youth Services.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
Now it's time for sport. Des Cahill, good morning to you.
Hi Mary, how are you? Late night for those of us watching the US Open golf last night.
And more to come.
Yeah, more to come. But it didn't quite get finished actually because of light. And the Irish are within striking distance. Reporting on it all is Greg Allen.
After bad light forced a suspension of play due to early fog in San Diego, this was the second US Open in a row with vastly better first round scoring than expected, and pre-championship tales of unplayable rough that might even cause injury to players proved well wide of the mark. And so there's a two-way tie for the lead on 4-under involving Russell Henley, the world number 63 ranked player, and the 2010 Open champion Louis Westhuizen, and they are one shot clear of two Europeans on 3-under, Rafa Cabrera-Bello and Francesco Molinari. Now, it looked for quite a while that Rory McIlroy wouldn't just shrug off a sequence of poor starts in the majors and actually possibly challenge for the lead, but the early promise of a 2-under par front nine began to dissipate as the grey afternoon gloom set in. And if it wasn't for an encouragingly sharp short game on the back nine, in particular a 15-foot par-saving putt on 17, he would have drifted over par figures. But in surviving that crisis, McIlroy then finished with a birdie on 18 to sign for a round of 1-under par 70, two strokes better than the 1-over par 72 that leaves Shane Lowry also in a very decent challenging position. And speaking of challengers, once again, Brooks Koepka, who is far and away the most successful player in the majors over the last 4 years, he is right up there after a round of 2-under par 69, and he says there's no mystery to his consistency in the majors.
It's pretty simple. It's a lot simpler than what guys make it. A lot of guys make it more difficult than it needs to be. It's just all about discipline in the US Open.
The pre-tournament favourite John Rahm also opened with a 69, as did Xander Schauffele, while world number one Dustin Johnson shot a level par 71.
All right, thanks, Greg. Meanwhile, the Cavan woman is at it again on the LPGA Tour, Leona Maguire. Brilliant round from her. She's tied for the lead after the opening round of Michigan, beginning with a bogey-free 7-under par 65. Stephanie Meadow is one over in that one. In soccer, the Euros last night, and the Netherlands assured themselves of a place in the last 16 with a 2-0 victory over Austria. The goals came from Denzel Dumfries and a Memphis Depay penalty. In the same group, Ukraine beat North Macedonia 2-1. And Belgium booked a place in the knockout stages. After a 2-1 defeat of Denmark, Kevin De Bruyne scored the winner in a thrilling Group B encounter in Copenhagen. Today's games, well, Sweden play Slovakia at 2 o'clock. It's Croatia versus Czech Republic at 5. And at 8 o'clock, England take on Scotland at Wembley. The England manager, Gareth Southgate, has said Manchester United defender Harry Maguire will be involved in the England squad, having been out since May with an ankle injury.
Harry will be involved tomorrow. Decision we've got to make is whether he's ready to start. But we're really pleased with his progress. He's trained with the team for 4 or 5 days now, and had no reaction. And of course, each session that he's involved with, he gets more confident. And I think he's on a really good path. So, of course, we want everybody available. It causes difficult decisions, but at the moment. This morning on the training pitch, we had 26 players training, and that's a great situation for us to be in.
Now, Scotland are complete underdogs after they lost 2-0 at home to the Czech Republic on Monday. What did Celtic striker Lee Griffiths make of that performance?
Yeah, I thought the performance was good. I think, the chances we created were positive. But you've got to give credit to the Czech Republic as well. They played well, they took the chances we needed to, and I think it was one of the games where doesn't matter who the chances fell to, we weren't going to put the ball in the back of the net.
The manager made out that the chances were positive, the fact he created so many. Looking at that as a striker, is that encouraging for you moving forward?
Yeah, of course it is. You've seen the impact that Shea Adams came off the bench and had. It was a real big spark up front. I think we're on the front foot, and the second goal was, I would say, it was a bit freaky. but you know, they're the kind of chances you need to take, and especially, you know, the chances we created the second half, we hit the bar as well. On another day, we're going to score 4 or 5.
Now, there's also a full list of games at home tonight. The Premier Division leaders Shamrock Rovers go to Waterford, and Sligo have a tricky game at St Pat's. Vinnie Perth takes charge of Dundalk at home to Longford, and elsewhere it's Bowes versus Drogheda and Finn Harps versus Derry City. The First Division leaders Shelburne are away to Wexford. In tennis, Naomi Osaka has withdrawn from this year's Wimbledon tournament. The world number two continues to take a break from the sport, although she does plan to return in time for the Olympic Games in Tokyo. Rafa Nadal will not compete at Wimbledon or the Olympics to allow his body recover from the demands of the clay court season. Horse racing, and after Stradivarius was beaten in the Gold Cup yesterday, with the Tony Mullins-trained Princess Zoe finishing second to Subjectivist, the feature today is the Coronation Stakes. There's also action at home at Down Royal, where 500 spectators will be allowed in, and at Limerick.
UK has asked the EU for an extension to the grace period for importing chilled meats from Britain to Northern Ireland. Checks are supposed to start from the end of the month under the Northern Ireland Protocol. So does this mean the so-called sausage wars between Brussels and London have been averted, or could be averted for now? Our Europe editor Tony Connolly has all the ins and outs. Tony, fill us in on London's request for an extension and the EU reaction so far.
Well, under the Northern Ireland Protocol, as you mentioned, Anya, there is normally a ban on chilled meats or non-frozen meats entering the European Union from a third country. So that includes sausages, mince pies, composite meals and so on. So under the Northern Ireland Protocol, normally they would have been banned from entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain. But last December, the EU and UK agreed that there would be a grace period lasting until the 1st of July. And the point of that grace period was that essentially, certainly in the EU's view, the supermarket sector in Northern Ireland would change their supply chains to get those kinds of meats from elsewhere. Now, we've already seen the UK unilaterally extending grace periods for other parts of the protocol, or extending derogations and so on without consulting the EU. And the expectation was they would do the same for chilled meats from the 1st of July. However, they have now made a formal request to the EU to extend that grace period, and the EU has said they will assess the request. Now, it may take them some time to assess it. My guess is they probably won't want to have an all-out clash with the UK on the 1st of July over sausages and mince and so on. Mm-hmm. So they will probably agree to an extension, but again, with strict conditions. And there were conditions originally in the deal back in December, and the EU says the UK didn't abide by those conditions. So, you know, there is some irritation in Brussels at this request, yeah, but we'll see what happens.
And it is a request, I suppose, not a unilateral action on the UK side. On the other hand, if Boris Johnson keeps getting extensions for bits of the protocol he doesn't want to operate, it starts veering into cakeism, doesn't it? Having your cake and eating it on the protocol.
Yes, I mean, on your first point, it is important to note that the UK has asked for this extension formally. They haven't just done it themselves unilaterally. So that is will be seen as something in Brussels. But again, the European Union believes that the UK had a set of conditions which they had to comply with in order for that grace period to be agreed back in December. This is around packaging, making sure that any goods of this nature that come into Northern Ireland don't go any further, that they're well labelled, and that the UK would abide by EU's food safety and animal health rules for the duration of the grace period. And some of those conditions, the Commission is saying, have not been met. The other thing, again, is that they simply don't want to get into a situation of rolling derogations and rolling extensions of grace periods. They say that that's not going to help business in Northern Ireland prepare for the future. It's not going to create a stable situation. So I think if they do agree to this extension, it will be done very reluctantly.
Europe editor Tony Connolly in Brussels, thank you. It's
scolded by the G7 and NATO leaders, who said it presents systemic challenges. China has been the focus of a united front of condemnation from the West. Its response best summed up as butt out of our affairs. Joe Biden has urged his fellow NATO leaders to stand up to China's authoritarianism and growing military might. Then, 2 days ago, 28 Chinese Air Force aircraft entered the Taiwan Air Defence Zone, the largest incursion to date. To put some context on what's happening, I'm joined by Yvonne Murray, our reporter in Taipei. And Yvonne, let's start with that incursion and the significance of the timing of this incursion coming as it did following on the NATO and G7 meetings.
This is designed by Beijing to be a dramatic display of military strength and to kind of underline the point that they are no longer going to accept being bossed around by a small group of rich nations. And a demonstration that any inclusion of Taiwan in the G7 statement is utterly unacceptable to Beijing. They consider it an interference in their sovereign internal affairs. That alongside the situation in Hong Kong, in Xinjiang, they consider completely out of bounds for the international community. And they see that this, as you mentioned, this united front that Biden has managed to bring about with Europe and other parts of the world is to them threatening. And they have lashed out in a characteristically very angry fashion.
So the response, can we take it, Yvonne, will be more of these shows of strength rather than any attempt to start entering into some form of dialogue?
I can't see China entering into any form of dialogue at the moment, at least not publicly. I mean, we have to look at this in the context of what happened previous to Biden taking office. During the Trump years, China had made quite significant progress in kind of breaking that Atlantic alliance by bringing Europe much closer to Beijing, culminating in the China investment agreement, EU investment agreement, which was agreed towards the end of Trump's term. And that was an indication that it had managed to drive a wedge between the Europe and the US. And now seeing Biden turn that around and bring Europe back into the fold and present a united front against China is something that it's very angry about, but it's also somewhat rattled about. This is exactly what they didn't want to see. And their reaction, while very angry and very kind of ultra-nationalistic in public, there is definitely disquiet in Beijing. This is not what they wanted to see. And if there is any negotiation, it will definitely be quietly behind the scenes.
The Cold War is over, Yvonne, yet are we seeing lines drawn here? Are we seeing China draw even closer to Russia?
Yeah, that again, it's very interesting to see the echoes of the Cold War in this in these new kind of geopolitical shifts that are taking place. And especially this week, seeing the China's rocket launch into space, the largest manned flight into space, and then the US saying that they wouldn't be able to join the International Space Station, and that China instead will team up with Russia in its space race. So again, this really does seem like a new Cold War, and the concern in this region, especially over the issue of Taiwan, is that it does not turn into a hot war, which of course would be very worrying for the whole planet.
And yet, Yvonne, is it a case of business is business is business? And despite these global rifts, you still have the US and China and Europe still cooperating in finance and trade and business.
This is it. And I think this market of China, which is just so enormous, is far too tempting for companies all around the world, especially companies who are struggling in the wake of the pandemic to really generate business at home. They see the Chinese market as their only way out of these doldrums. Plus, you see on Wall Street now, US investors lining up to invest in China's capital markets. So yes, we have this kind of more angry rhetoric across the globe, but behind the scenes, that business community is not going to be turned off the Chinese market. It's too tempting, it's too big, and too attractive.
No gestures to come then from China, and you've reported extensively on the Uyghur people in the past and what they're suffering. You're not likely to see any moves by China to ease back on human rights abuses that are alleged against them.
Yeah, absolutely not. And I think that's really key to understand about this week as well. It's almost like the more the international community pushes China on these issues, especially on human rights in the Xinjiang region, the more they seem to dig their heels in. Turning to the other issue of Hong Kong, only yesterday we saw a raid on the Apple Daily newspaper offices, really driving home this point that China will continue its aggressive policies to bring Hong Kong into line with Beijing. And it just doesn't care what the international community says. That's the new reality. And I think the problem with what's happened with the G7 this week is that they haven't quite come up with a plan to deal with this aggressive policy from Beijing, and which it does not seem to be backing down on.
For now, Yvonne Murray in Taipei, thank you.
Revolut hopes to be able to offer credit card and loan products to Irish users later this year, its CEO has told Morning Ireland. But speaking to RTE after his virtual appearance at the Dublin Tech Summit, Nick Storonski said the exact timing of the launch would depend on when it secures licences from the central bank here. Revolut applied to the central bank for an e-money licence last year, and once secured, it plans to apply for a full banking licence, giving it more ways to compete with traditional banks. So I started by asking about that central bank process, which he said has taken longer than expected.
To be honest, I think they have a lot of applications because of Brexit, and I think they have a large backlog. So that's reason number one. And then reason number two is we're obviously in a very large institution for Ireland.
When you do get that license, hopefully, and when you get your banking license, what will you be offering to Irish customers? Will they be able to get loans, credit cards, and maybe even mortgages from Revolut?
We already started working on credit card and loans. We're actually going to launch it even possibly this year, but maybe Q1 or next year, given that car loans and mortgages require quite a lot of capital, and then we prefer to be in capital-efficient business and capital-light business.
You have an office in Dublin, of course. What role does that play, and will that play in your expansion plans, particularly in the context of post-Brexit?
They're focused on e-money, banking, and trading licenses. So we plan to use Ireland to be a Western Europe hub, Lithuania's Eastern Europe hub, and then separately having HQ in the UK.
On the user side, there have been issues cropping up as well. Some saying, for example, getting locked out of their accounts and not being able to find out the reason why that is. Are you worried that that's the kind of issue that will put them off and will force them into the hands of a competitor?
Yeah, ultimately, we will try to make the experience as smooth as possible. But I mean, the reality is a problem with regulation, right? So regulation clearly says that, you know, if a system or our anti-money laundering system suspects there is, you know, something wrong with the account, we must stop a user transacting.
But is it also about your response and being quicker in identifying if it is an issue, and if not, giving access back to the customer?
We're working hard in terms of, you know, timelines to get an account unlocked and investigated is pretty fast now, but maybe a year or 2 years ago, it was rather long.
You've also added a lot of new options besides, you know, transactions and your vault as well, your savings. For example, people able to trade stocks and increasingly more and more cryptocurrencies through the app. But should you be doing more to warn people about the risks of these kinds of investments as well? You do make money on stock and crypto trades. So is there a potential conflict of interest there in sitting that offering alongside someone's savings and you know, making it very easy for them and very attractive for them to make those investments?
I mean, our philosophy is basically, if you want to invest money in stocks or in crypto, we need to provide you the best product possible in the market. And then if investment is risky and investment is volatile, we show you all the warning signs about, you know, trading in stocks and crypto. But ultimately, if you as a customer decide to trade crypto or stock, you'd rather do it through us.
Revolut CEO Nick Storonski there. In other financial news, Avant Money has launched a range of long-term fixed mortgages, potentially allowing customers to fix their rate for the entire duration of their loan term. The One Mortgage products includes fixed rates for 15, 20, 25 or 30 years, depending on the loan-to-value ratio. The 30-year rate is fixed at between 2.85 and 3.1%.
Don't go abroad if you're under 30. That's the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mail, summing up the advice of the Chief Medical Officer, that those who are not fully vaccinated should not go abroad, regardless of whether they have a negative PCR test. Dr. Tony Houlihan's advice gives the Irish Independent its lead story too. Young told to keep lives on hold, says the headline, though the report below that quotes Dr. Houlihan as saying there's plenty of good holiday opportunities in this country. The Irish Times' latest opinion poll provides further thought on the subject. 50% of respondents said they want the government to proceed with the full reopening of society as quickly as possible. But almost the same number, 46%, said they want the reopening to take place at a much slower pace. There is much coverage of the tributes paid to a 15-year-old County Carlow girl, Tiggy Hancock, who died following an accident at an equestrian centre in Dublin. The Irish Daily Star says she was a rising star in the sport of eventing. The Irish Daily Mirror quotes a family friend, Edmund Carney, who said that Tiggy represented Ireland several times and she had a very bright future. A criticism of the Taoiseach by the deputy leader of Sinn Féin provides the Irish Examiner's lead story. Pearse Doherty accused Leo Varadkar of failing to understand public anger at the housing crisis by playing down concerns about property prices, the paper says. The Taoiseach features in a Times front page story too, where he is quoted as saying that there are problems with the new National Maternity Hospital project. The proposed site on the St. Vincent's campus in Dublin is owned by the Religious Sisters of Charity, who plan to gift it to a new body that will run the hospital. The Times reports that at a private briefing with the Minister for Health yesterday, government and opposition TDs were told that the state has tried everything possible to buy the land which the hospital will be built on, but has failed to do so. A cartoon takes up half of the front page of the Irish News. It's by Ian Knox, and it shows two men being whirled out a revolving door, presumably Edwin Poots and Paul Given, while Arlene Foster looks on, grinning. Poots stands down as DUP implodes, says the headline. The story gets a more sober treatment in the Belfast Telegraph, but the message is the same. Poots out after 21 days as leader, is the headline, over a dark photograph by Brian Lawless of the short-lived head of the Democratic Unionist Party in Stormont yesterday. Voters don't deserve such farcical politics, says the paper in an editorial. The speed with which the Poots putsch unravelled is unprecedented, says the Irish News. The Examiner comments that the debacle further destabilises an already fragile Stormont. The only certainty now is that the path ahead will be challenging, says the writer. The Times says as Northern Ireland emerges from the COVID-19 pandemic and navigates the early period of the post-Brexit era, it badly needs both political stability and cohesive leadership. An ugly, protracted war in the largest unionist party makes both harder to achieve. The threat that hangs in the air is real, says the Independent. With unionism in meltdown, as evidenced by the chaos within the DUP, and a high-stakes showdown between the EU and the UK, it would be wise to get comfortable with silence.
Now, in the Dáil yesterday, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said he believed there were problems with the new National Maternity Hospital project. Plans to move the new National Maternity Hospital from Hollow Street, its present site, to the St. Vincent's University Hospital campus have been delayed for years because of issues around the ownership and religious ethos. Leo Varadkar said he was concerned that the land on which the hospital is built will not be gifted to the state, but to a private charity, St. Vincent's Holdings, and rented to the state under a 99-year lease. He was responding to questions from People Before Profit TD Breed Smith, who joins me now in studio. Good morning, Breed Smith.
Good morning.
And there was a briefing yesterday with the Department of Health, a briefing that you attended. What did you learn about the state of play now with the new National Maternity Hospital?
Well, I think probably coming out of the briefing, my concerns were even deepened. Not because nobody was trying to hide anything from us, but this is a very complex and difficult to understand procedure that's been going on basically since 2013. One of the officials told us she's been working on this all of those years. So you're looking at 8 years of torturous negotiations and attempts by the state several times to buy the land. And the sisters refused to sell the land to the state. They now say that they've gifted the land to the people of Ireland, but in reality it's gifted to a private charity that has been set up under the St. Vincent's Healthcare Group. And the St. Vincent's Healthcare Group is fully owned by the Order of the Sisters of Charity.
But important to say, Breed Smith, that the Sisters of Charity have no involvement now and have said they will have no future role in the management of St. Vincent's Hospital, good, bad or indifferent.
This is true, and we accept that they won't have any role in the management. However, they have appointed the directors of the new charity, who are free then to further appoint more directors or to replace themselves. And I doubt if the directors that they, and I'm not, you know, I don't know, but I doubt if the directors they appointed would be very, you know, forward thinking, progressive.
Well,
thinking.
You don't know.
But
that
we are
at
concerned
all.
About it. We're very concerned. And the Leo Varadkar shares our concerns.
Yeah. So, from the point of view of women and young girls today who will be looking to having a new state-of-the-art National Maternity Hospital co-located beside a university hospital, this seems even further away now.
Yeah, well, 3 years ago we changed the look of Ireland in terms of women's reproductive healthcare when the repeal referendum was passed by an overwhelming majority of the people. So repeal changes everything. And the Mulvey report, from which all of this complex, you know, company arrangement stems, was written pre-repeal. And having said that, with repeal change and everything, I asked the Tánaiste yesterday if the government would consider scrapping the Mulvey report and starting again, compulsory purchasing the land from the order and fully own the hospital, because at the current level, the land is leased back to the state for 99 years. That means we don't fully own the hospital. And, you know, in the 21st century, seriously, women's reproductive healthcare has to be run by the state.
The Tánaiste also said to you yesterday, you know, it is an absolute requirement that the hospital's constitution must specify that any procedures and treatments that are legal in the state are available in that hospital. And again, there's no indication that they wouldn't be.
There is no indication that they wouldn't be. But as I say, the board of directors have been appointed by the order, and they are free to appoint other boards of directors who will obviously be the ones that will employ the staff, etc.
So your worries are about what will happen down the road and
absolutely
into the future.
And maybe I won't be alive, maybe half the dollar will be gone, but we have to guarantee, it's our obligation to guarantee that this is done correctly and done to safeguard full reproductive rights for women into the future.
The thing is, though, isn't this the way a number of our voluntary hospitals would operate in this country?
It is, and isn't that the problem? And in fact, Sláinte Care was all about stopping that sort of, you know, ad hoc arrangement with voluntary hospitals. It was about moving to a fully funded National Health Service. We now have an opportunity to start doing that with a National Maternity Hospital that's fully owned and run by the state. And the state doesn't have control of the board, and that's a real worry. And I was surprised by the Tánaiste's reaction, because other ministers have not expressed that concern to us publicly in the past, but he's certainly shared it.
And just finally, you want full public ownership. If that is not possible in this situation, and we're not quite sure why from that briefing you're talking about yesterday, if that's not possible though, would you favour scrapping this project and starting again on a new greenfield site?
Well, I don't see why it wouldn't be possible for the state to compulsory purchase the land. Now, the Minister for Health said there may be litigation, there could be a long protracted legal process following that, but why would we have it? And if the sisters are genuine in what they're saying, they want to give this to the people of Ireland.
And there's no reason to believe they're not, 29
absolutely
acres plus land at St. Michael's in Dunleary.
Well, gift it to the state. The state represents the people of Ireland. The state has a duty of care to the people of Ireland. And this leaves a pile of ambiguity and complex arrangements, legal documents we haven't seen, and we've asked to see them. And we also believe that it is now hurtling towards the point that the HSE are checking out these legal documents, and we don't want to see them signed before we have full scrutiny and understanding. And our preference is for compulsory purchase order on the site.
Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD, thank you very much.
Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney joins us now. And Minister, yesterday you thought you had a deal that would keep power sharing on the road in Northern Ireland. You were tweeting about a good day's work after the agreement on legislating for the Irish Language and Cultures Act. It's all in tatters this morning without even a North-South ministerial conference. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are politics in Northern Ireland can be very unpredictable. And yesterday, you know, the Secretary of State and myself and indeed other party leaders in Northern Ireland were welcoming the fact that a new First Minister was appointed and Michelle O'Neill became reaffirmed as the Deputy First Minister. And it looked like we were going to have a plenary of the North-South Ministerial Council meeting this morning in Armagh. And it looked like, you know, we were moving on after a period of real disruption and change and uncertainty in the context of new leadership in the DUP. And then all of a sudden, that began to unravel, which was very unwelcome. And of course, now we have a lot of questions in terms of where do we go from here? Because leadership change is not something that the DUP does very often. You know, they've only ever had four leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, Ian Paisley, Peter Robinson, Arlene Foster, and Edwin Poots up until yesterday evening. So this is a party that doesn't change its leader very often, is not used to managing that. And of course, at a time of real pressure and polarization and uncertainty in Northern Ireland, the last thing politics in Northern Ireland needs now is the largest party in, you know, in a very divided and uncertain place, which is where the DUP are at the moment. So, I mean, from our perspective, we need to give the DUP space to respond to the challenges that they're facing. We know that the latest leadership contest, which resulted in Edwin Poots taking the leadership, was a very divisive one. We know the party was split virtually down the middle in relation to the vote between Edwin Poots and Geoffrey Donaldson. And, of course, the tension and divisions within the party in the build-up to the nomination of Paul Given to be First Minister was, you know, a step too far for many, in fact, a majority in the party. And so now we're back to square one, if you like, where the party has to find a way of electing a new leader that can unite the DUP, or at least attempt to. And that's important for politics in Northern Ireland, so that we have a First Minister and a leader of the DUP that we can deal with, negotiate with. We won't always agree with, for sure. But if you look at the challenges for Northern Ireland at the moment, from healthcare and the pandemic to the implementation of the New Decade, New Approach Agreement, to the issues around the protocol, to potentially a very tense summer in terms of a marching season, to North-South cooperation and so many other things. What's needed is stability and some predictability in Northern Irish politics. And, you know, you get it from much of the frustration that you're hearing from other political parties in Northern Ireland now, who simply want to get back to doing their job. And so, you know, I think now is a time to give the DUP some space to try to resolve these issues. But certainly it's, you know, it's adding to the list of real challenges that politics faces in Northern Ireland.
Given that Paul Given was elected First Minister against the wishes of most of his party, he was instructed not to go to the North-South Ministerial by the DUP Officer Board. Do you expect him to resign?
That's hard to tell. You know, it depends who you're listening to. And, you know, obviously we're trying to get as much information as we can. The DUP are remaining very tight-lipped in terms of their approach to the First Minister and, of course, electing a new leader, whether that will be by contest or whether they'll rally behind one name now is hard to know. But we'll have to wait and see what happens in relation to Paul Given as First Minister. As of now, he is the First Minister in Northern Ireland. He's been selected and elected yesterday into that position. But, of course, so much has changed in those 24 hours that you'd have to say there's a lot of uncertainty in relation to that issue.
Have you spoken to Brandon Lewis about what you do now, and does the Irish government expect that the deal that was at the heart of this row in the DUP, the deal on finally implementing the Irish Language and Culture Act that was agreed 15 years ago, reaffirmed 15 months ago, the DUP already signed up to it, but they didn't want to deliver it. Will the British government still legislate on that introduction?
Yes, they will. So I spoke to Brandon Lewis last night. I mean, despite what many people might think. Actually, my relationship with Brandon Lewis is very good. We speak all the time. And even when I was abroad this week, we were speaking regularly and we were in regular contact in the build-up to yesterday. And we had a very long meeting in Lockern last week when the British Irish Council was meeting as well. So, you know, the Secretary of State in Northern Ireland and the Foreign Minister in the Republic of Ireland need to be close and working together, particularly when there are difficult challenges to overcome. And we have been. And Brandon Lewis did the right thing here by committing to, if necessary, pass legislation in Westminster to deal with language and culture as committed to 18 months ago in the New Decade, New Approach Agreement, and as the British government agreed to do 15 years ago, if necessary. But the hope, of course, was that that wouldn't be necessary and that the executive and the assembly in Northern Ireland would be able to pass that legislation. Because don't forget, we agreed what the draft legislation would look like 18 months ago. There's nothing new here. This is simply following through on a commitment that was the basis of re-establishing the executive.
But you know that any new leader of the DUP is likely to have a mandate to go back and look for more concessions on that very package that you agreed.
That's true, except there's a written commitment from the Secretary of State and from the British government on that issue. So I don't expect that that's going to change. All of the other parties have accepted that. Even the UUP, John Beattie, is now saying, look, we should be legislating in the Assembly for language. That includes Ulster Scots as well as the Irish language, by the way. This was a balanced package on language and culture. It wasn't one-sided. And so I think it is the correct thing to do, to legislate and manage that issue within Northern Ireland, rather than having to outsource it to Westminster. But what Brandon Lewis has said, and he's correct, is to say if they're unable to do that, we've got to put a timeline or a backstop in place to ensure that if it doesn't happen in the Assembly in Northern Ireland, well, then the British government will effectively follow through on the commitments that have been made. And I think he was right to do that. You know, Edwin Coutts didn't like that, but accepted it. But I think many in his party didn't and couldn't accept that. But I think that also is linked to the deep divisions within the party that stem back a number of weeks in terms of the end of Arlene Foster's leadership as well. And don't forget how divided the DUP have been for a number of weeks now. And this in many ways was a trigger rather than the only reason for what happened yesterday.
Are autumn elections now inevitable, which many observers think they were? For instance, the DUP advisor Lee Reynolds on Newsnight last night saying the mood in unionism is powerfully against devolution at this stage between the protocol and the Irish Language Act.
No, I'm not sure about that. I mean, you know, when you hear a number of the party leaders talking, many of them want to get back to focusing on doing their jobs.
But they need the DUP there too, don't they?
Of course they do. Of course they do. But I also think there are many in the DUP who will look at the interests of Northern Ireland here and determine that what's needed now is stability and political leadership as opposed to an election at a time of real polarisation and tension across Northern Ireland within communities and society. Now, don't forget the difficulties and the tension linked to the implementation of the protocol and the fallout from Brexit is still very live across Northern Ireland. And we all have an obligation to try to calm those tensions, to respond to genuine concerns, to show flexibility and pragmatism in terms of how that protocol is implemented. The EU understands that. The EU and the British government have an obligation to try to find a way forward on those things, and the Irish government has been very much involved in trying to do that. And I think the idea that we introduce an election in the middle of all of that, in the short term, which in some ways would be a referendum on the protocol and on some of the issues of division that we've seen, means that the election would be based on polarization and division, as opposed to focusing on policy change and governance to deal with the problems in Northern Ireland. And I think, you know, we have enough challenges right now without a very divisive, polarizing election in Northern Ireland. But that is what could happen if political leadership can't find a way of stabilizing things in Northern Ireland. Don't forget, we're not due an election in Northern Ireland until next May. And my strong view is that if we can support the re-establishment of an executive that can focus on solving problems and working together. That is far preferable to an early election, and I think everybody should work towards that end.
And in stressing, Minister, stability, leadership, the importance of calming tensions, what then about your own party leader? And the criticism there has been of the timing of his remarks in a week of leadership change in the DUP, even though nobody could foresee what was going to happen yesterday. But the timing of his remarks, which many unionists have been very critical of.
Well, I mean, you know, I think it would be very wrong to link what happened yesterday afternoon in terms of the end of Edwin Poots's leadership with anything that the Taoiseach has said. I mean, these are entirely separate issues. There has been a debate for some time now, accelerated in many ways by Brexit and issues around Brexit, amongst nationalism in Northern Ireland, around what the future holds for the island, how we can work together in partnership, how we can plan for the future, and what Leo Varadkar was doing, which is, by the way, absolutely party policy in Fine Gael and has been for decades, is being to talk about the reality that at some point in his lifetime, he thinks that he may see reunification on this island because the majority of people may want that. And we have to think about that and design what results from that by reaching out to unionism and different strands of opinion on the island. Because the approach to reunification that Fine Gael take is a far more inclusive one, far more generous one, far more modern one, we would say, than what some other parties are advocating for, which is aggressive and short-term and leads to fear and anxiety within unionism in particular. The approach to this issue that Fine Gael wants to lead is one that actually reaches out and listens and accommodates difference as opposed to anything else. And that's the point that Leo Varadkar was trying to make this week. And I think if you read his speech in full, you'll see a big difference between the language that Fine Gael are using and some other parties are basing their vision for the future on.
Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
Now, a great sporting weekend ahead. Des Cahill here with the details.
Yeah, and it got underway with the US Open Golf in California last night. Round one didn't quite get finished as darkness descended, but there's still lots for Greg Allen to tell us about.
In near darkness last night, Rory McIlroy managed to hole what could end up being a crucial putt come Sunday. It was from all of 15 feet to save par on the 17th, and then he made another from 6 feet for birdie on 18, and it all added up to a round of 1 under par 70, and that marked the first time McIlroy had broken par in the first round of a major since last year's US Open. The 90-minute fog delay at the start of the day meant that play in the opening round didn't quite reach conclusion, but McIlroy managed to squeeze in the final hole just as the hooter went, and his reward was that closing birdie, which took him within just 3 shots of the leaders on 4 under, the veteran South African Louis Westhuizen, who still has 2 holes to play incidentally, and the American Russell Henley, who has never had a top 10 in the majors but is far from unheralded. He was once one of the world's best amateurs and is also a 3-time PGA Tour winner, and he's got no shortage of self-belief.
I definitely felt comfortable out there. I feel confident with my game. I don't feel like it's a huge surprise just because I do feel like I've played some good golf in some bigger events. But, you know, in terms of putting 4 rounds together at the US Open, I've struggled with that. And so I'm just going to keep trying.
Henley and Westhuizen are one clear of 2 men on 3 under, Rafa Cabrera-Bello and Francesco Molinari, while Brooks Koepka, twice a US Open winner in the last 4 years, and the pre-tournament favourite John Rahm are in the group on 2 under. Shane Lowry battled back from a triple bogey 7 on the 4th hole to restrict the damage with 3 birdies, which helped him get back to a 1 over par 72. Meanwhile, Phil Mickelson's quest at 51 years of age to win the one major championship that has eluded him got off to a poor start with a 75, but he actually wasn't overly disheartened.
I fought really hard, and then to let 2 bogeys slide on 6 and 7 when I really shouldn't have, like they weren't that hard a par.
like I said, like I'm hitting enough fairways to give myself chances, and I'm optimistic that I'll put together a good round tomorrow.
And the PGA champion Mickelson wasn't the only prominent name over par figures, as Colin Morikawa shot a 75 as well, while Jordan Spieth shot a 77, but a steady start for the world number one Dustin Johnson with a 71.
Meanwhile, Leona Maguire's great form continues on the LPGA Tour. Leona is tied for the lead in the opening round of Michigan after beginning with a fantastic bogey-free 7 under par 65. Stephanie Meadow is one over. To soccer now and the European Championships, and the Netherlands assured themselves of a place in the last 16 with a 2-0 victory over Austria. The goals came from Denzel Dumfries and a Memphis Depay penalty. In the same group, Ukraine beat North Macedonia 2-1. And Belgium booked a place in the knockout stages too. They had a 2-1 victory over Denmark in Copenhagen, Kevin De Bruyne scoring the winner in a thrilling game. In today's matches, Sweden plays Slovakia at 2 o'clock. It's Croatia versus the Czech Republic at 5. And at 8 o'clock, England take on Scotland at Wembley. England are red-hot favourites. And despite losing 2-0 to the Czech Republic on Monday, Geraint Vincent discovered Scottish fans are still full of hope as they travel south.
You can't beat it travelling down. Even when you've got tickets, you still want to come down and just be a part of it, don't you?
I've all seen pictures of years ago when the guys were down, so thought we wanted to be in amongst it.
Scotland used to play England every year back in the days of the home championship, and Wembley was always a favourite destination for Scotland's travelling support. Things got carried away after the tourists won in 1977, including the goalposts. Their visits since have been rarer and not always as happy. In the 1996 Euros, there was that missed penalty.
A brilliant save!
And Gazza's famous goal, which sealed an England win.
For England, and it's 2-0.
Celebrating Scotland's return to major tournament football this year are a group of friends who began the 668-mile journey from the country's most northerly town, Thurso, earlier this week. And arrived in Wembley.
With the COVID thing in our rails, normally we come down with about 50 guys, only here about 5 or 6 of us, so we're trying to make it the best we can.
Expectations, 2-1.
To Scotland.
2-1, oh, of course to Scotland, yes.
I mean, that'd be a popular result, I think. But England red hot favourites, as I say. All those games live on RT2 today. There's also a full list of games at home. Premier Division leaders Shamrock Rovers go to Waterford. Sligo face a tricky journey to St Pat's. Vinnie Perth takes charge of Dundalk at home to Longford. Elsewhere, it's Bohemians against Drogheda and Finn Harps versus Derry City. The First Division leaders Shelburne are away to Wexford. It's an unusual weekend at Gaelic Games, unusually quiet. We've only two games of significance. The Camogie League final on Sunday evening sees Galway take on Kilkenny, but before that, tomorrow evening, we've the first game in Croke Park since last year's All-Ireland finals. I'll be there for Saturday Sport to mark the occasion as Offaly take on Derry in the only Football League final that will take place in 2021, as Offaly meet Derry in the Division 3 decider. What does Tomás O'Shea make of it all?
Des, it's absolutely brilliant to have a final back in Croke Park again. The only downside for me is fellas are looking for tickets. It's easier to get a ticket for an All-Ireland final than it is for this match, I can tell you that for nothing. Offaly are back up to Division 2 and there's a lot of excitement there. 16 seasons since they've been up there. John Mahan has done really, really well with them. There's an enthusiasm above there and there's an organisation above there that's really, you can admire it. We all saw what it meant to them last week going up. Yet again, another example of how the league system, it works. It works for all teams, not only the strong, everybody has a chance, and Offaly deserve to be up. They beat Wicklow, Limerick, Tipperary and Fermanagh last week. Was a huge win for them. You wouldn't have predicted that at the start of the year either. You know, Bernard Allen, Cian Farrell, they're brilliant scorers. Their bench, look at last week, the goal, the all-important goal, Niall McNamee intercepted the ball, Mark Abbott got the goal. But Derry Des will be a very, very tough test for them. Rory Gallagher has taken his fair share of criticism for his style of football, like at Donegal and Fermanagh, how defensive it was. But I think here he's got a good balance. Like, Derry play an exciting brand of football. Defensive, yes, but they're energetic, they're hardworking, and they're organised. Shane McGuigan is an absolute class act. I love watching him. Niall Loughlin, Conor Glass, Garrett McInnes, they're footballers. Benny Herron, they're actual brilliant footballers, but they're organised and they work very, very hard. I'm going to go with a Derry win, Des, and say well done to both teams for number one wanting to play the final and number two actually going after it and playing it.
Yeah, fair point. I think everyone would be wishing the other finals had been played as well. In tennis, Naomi Osaka has withdrawn from this year's Wimbledon tournament. The world number two continues to take a break from the sport, although she does plan to return in time for the Olympic Games. Rafa Nadal says he won't compete at Wimbledon or the Olympics to allow his body recover from the demands of the clay court season. Finally, horse racing. After Stradivarius was beaten in the Gold Cup yesterday at Royal Ascot, with the Tony Mullins trained Princess Zoe finishing second to Subjectivist, the feature today is the Coronation Street Stakes, and we also have racing at home. Down Royal will have 500 spectators allowed in, and there's also action at Limerick.
Let's talk to our health correspondent Fergal Bowers. And Fergal, I think it gave us all a lift yesterday when you, a veteran of so many NPHET briefings, told us it was the most positive that you'd attended. Will you take us through the highlights?
Well, the coronavirus outbreak has begun to shrink here. That's what we heard. And we are in a very positive situation. The case numbers are falling rapidly. Cases are declining by 3% a day. The average daily case count is now down to 322. Vaccinations is playing a big part of this, but also the public actions too. That has to be recognised. We do need to keep an eye on the incidence among people aged 18 to 24, which is, you know, I suppose, persistently high. But the numbers in hospital are declining. It's all very encouraging. And yes, yesterday's NPHET briefing, it felt like perhaps we're close to the end of this really dreadful period of history here in Ireland.
Can I do a few whatabouts? And let's start with, what about the Delta variant?
Well, we see the exponential growth of the Delta variant in England, and in Northern Ireland last night it was announced that plans to lift restrictions would be deferred to July 5th due to concerns there. But here we're doing better with the Delta variant. 188 sequenced cases, most of these in Dublin. There's no rapid growth in cases. The chief medical officer said it had been, you know, intercepted here quickly in the context of travel into Ireland. But obviously there's no room for complacency and it needs to be monitored closely.
And what about travel out of Ireland, where you have perhaps, you know, mum and dad already vaccinated, but their children are not?
Well, NPHET is advising people not to travel unless they're fully vaccinated, but they're not saying to fully vaccinated parents, don't travel because their children aren't vaccinated. Why is that? Well, that's because NPHET has not advised for children to be vaccinated, so it doesn't arise in that case. So the National Immunisation Advisory Committee is still looking at the issue of vaccinating children, but no decisions there.
And just finally, because we had a HSE briefing as well yesterday about the cyber attack and where the HSE is now in terms of rebooting the system.
Well, we're on day 36 after the cyber attack and it's still having an impact, and we were told it will be for weeks, if not months. One issue it's hitting is emergency departments, which we haven't heard a lot about, I guess, over the last year in particular. The HSE is seeing increased levels of demand over and above what you'd normally see, increased presentations and increased admissions, higher levels of frailty and acuity. The point being that GPs can't necessarily access tests, so patients are being sent to emergency departments, adding to the pressures. Also, when society opens up, which is a positive thing, unfortunately, you see more injuries and accidents. So partially, it's a good sign in one way of how we're getting back to normal, whatever normal is now after the last 15 months we've all experienced.
Well, long may positive briefings continue. Fergal Bowers, thank you.
And we'll go back to our main news this morning. Edwin Poot's resignation as DUP leader after a day of bitter infighting in the party. Our reporter Joan O'Sullivan's been talking to Jim Wells, DUP MLA for South Down. In the last few minutes, he gave her his reaction.
Well, I've been at Stormont 27 years and I have to say it's the most dramatic 24 hours that I have ever experienced. No one could have predicted what happened yesterday. It was a shock to us all, and I think it's quite sad because I think Edwin Poots had huge potential and could have been an excellent party leader for the DUP. It's just a pity he never got a chance to show it. An agreement was done at 1 a.m. yesterday morning. Members of Parliament and MLAs wanted an opportunity to consider it in detail before agreeing to the nomination of a First Minister. For some reason, which is yet to emerge, Edwin decided not to give them that time, and they voted by a substantial majority not to proceed with the nomination. He did so, and the inevitable happened, very sadly.
Many people now say it is also inevitable that Geoffrey Donaldson will be the most likely candidate to replace Edwin Poots. Do you think that's the case? And if Geoffrey Donaldson does become the new leader of the DUP, can he unite the party?
Well, Geoffrey was very narrowly defeated for the leadership only a month ago. And I think everyone is suggesting that he would be a very strong candidate. Certainly, I think Geoffrey can unite the party. I think he's respected at every level. I just hope that he's given time to develop his policies and to lead the party into the next election. We haven't had one election in 50 years, now we've had two in 50 days, which is an extraordinary situation. But whoever's elected, it's absolutely vital that the party unites behind that person and gives him or her their total support.
Jim Wells, the DUP MLA for South Down, talking to Joan O'Sullivan. And joining us now is Emma Little-Pengelly, former DUP MP in Westminster and advisor to Arlene Foster. And Emma Little-Pengelly, you know, you'd have been on different sides to Jim Wells in that recent leadership contest. You said last night Edwin Poots had a plan to oust Arlene Foster, but he didn't have a plan for what came after. Tell us more.
Well, I think certainly in terms of his leadership over the course of the first 2 weeks, the last couple of weeks of his leadership, it has been a very difficult start for him. There was no doubt about that. Very often we talk about a leadership bounce. I think for Edwin Poots, it was more like a bungee jump, and it was a number of challenges. It was almost a bit of a nightmare every single day. So he didn't get any positive bounce when he came in. In fact, he was faced with a huge number of challenges. So he had a very difficult start. I think then that was made worse by what happened then over the course of Wednesday night and into Thursday. And it all comes down, I think, to this very critical point, which I think was mentioned by Jim Wells there, that he made a decision, a leadership decision, late on Wednesday night to agree to nominate First Minister in light of what the Secretary of State was intending to do on the cultural package. Now, that is unusual in terms of the way that the DUP, and in fact I suspect most political parties, but it would be very unusual in the way that the DUP would normally do business. The way they would normally do these types of things would be to take back that proposal, to speak to the elected representatives, speak to the MLAs, the MPs, and perhaps even usually go wider than that to speak to, for example, the councillors of the party, the wider membership of the party, to try to get a sense about, is this something that the party wants to do? And I think critically, those members of the party, particularly elected representatives, want the opportunity to listen to the detail of that, to understand why the party leader would be recommending that, and feed into that decision. Okay. He didn't do that. He made the decision himself late on Wednesday night. He decided then on Thursday morning to go ahead with the nomination against, which we now know the majority of the elected representatives, who didn't want that to happen on Thursday. And I think it was that was fatal to his leadership.
Do you expect now that Paul Given will resign as First Minister, having been elected yesterday on Edwin Poots' nomination?
Well, I think certainly in the first instance that's an internal matter for the DUP. I haven't been privy to the discussions or where the MLAs and the MPs are on that issue. I think first and foremost it's a matter for Paul Given himself. He will know now that he has been nominated in circumstances where the majority of his colleagues, elected representatives, did not want him to be nominated. That puts him, I think, in a very difficult position.
Because if he goes now, power sharing goes, doesn't it?
Yes, on the other side of that, I think, is the balance off around the stability that I know that the DUP and in fact all people in Northern Ireland will want to see. And of course, you know, the problem here is that the very strange mechanism and procedure that happens whenever a First Minister resigns. Arlene Foster resigned last Friday. That effectively triggered a 7-day negotiation period because, of course, the DUP cannot nominate a First Minister without Sinn Féin agreeing to also nominate a Deputy First Minister. Sinn Féin have demonstrated time and time again that they are prepared to put preconditions on that. That's what they did over the course of this week, which made it very difficult for Edwin Poots. And it was a precondition on a very specific issue that they wanted around the New Decade, New Agreement deal. However, there are a number of things in that agreement that, of course, have not been yet implemented. And I think that's the big challenge for any DUP leader coming in, because particularly the unionist community, will want to see other aspects of that also implemented, not just that the agreement is cherry-picked and certain issues pulled off that progressed because that is a priority just for one party.
Thank you for your time this morning. Emma Little-Pengelly, former DUP MP.
And it's that time of year again when the public is asked to choose the nation's favourite building. From workplaces to wellbeing spaces, as they're now called, from homes to new public spaces for outdoor enjoyment. Kieran O'Connor is president of the Royal Institute of Architects of Ireland. Kieran, good morning. And
good morning.
There are 39 nominations. We can't go through them all. But maybe just tell me about maybe three that show the diverse range of buildings involved.
Well, you're right, Mary. I mean, there was a huge variety of projects from, like, the Swiss Cottage in Mohill, County Leitrim, to a student building in UCC, from Carlingford Castle to a house in Clifton. But ones that would stand out as just in different elements would be the social housing in Deanrock by Cork City Architects, which is a brownfield site redeveloped and replacing an old flat complex, and yet gives a good high density of use. And it's a real case of where ideas, not ideology, have taken place, so that the aspect of managing housing and how to provide for it, which is a national crisis, has to be addressed. Similarly, the Bus Air in Broadstone Garage building, which is the original 1850 termini coming into Dublin, has now had an adaptive restoration and reuse and has now been given a lifespan of another 80 years. A project done in India by one of our architects, McCullough Mulvin, where they did a complete new university in the Punjab there, which has a whole lot of climate issues to it and how it resolves that.
Okay, and buildings overseas designed by Irish architects can be included in this, and I'll tell people how they can vote in a minute. But how much or to what extent has the pandemic and COVID influenced the designs involved here?
These designs would have been completed before the pandemic, effectively would have been completed, but how the pandemic is affecting things now is that really buildings with air conditioning and stuff would have to upgrade the quality of their air delivery, and it really means we need to move to natural ventilation, which is a thing we should be on the move towards. Natural ventilation has huge benefits, and air conditioning, what people forget, has a cost of about €25 per square metre per year for the life of the building, in addition to the rent. So it's a significant cost, and it's not a qualitative element, and we really do need to move towards natural ventilation.
Will it change the height of buildings, or will it necessitate in all buildings now the inclusion of significant outdoor space available?
Yeah, I think the argument about height is a distraction. Really, what we need to do is medium density, medium rise buildings. If you look at the successful cities like Copenhagen, which was like Dublin 25 years ago and has been densified, but densified without any degeneration of quality. And that's where the architects really come into their own, because you're working with more restrictions and you have to get small spaces, then have to work harder to do all the jobs that a larger canvas would allow. So I think they're the sort of things we have to learn from it and to make a 20-minute city. It's a 20-minute city people can walk and work and do what they need to do.
It is the opportunity to select the nation's favourite building. Online voting is now open and all of the public choice projects are available to view on the RIAI website. That's riai.ie, and voting closes at midnight on Friday, the 2nd of July. And Kieran O'Connor, thank you for joining us.